Hello, welcome to episode 5. I'm Andy Thomas, and this is the One to One podcast. Welcome.
Yep.
Got you here at last. So obviously I've known you since you was about 11 or 12.
Yeah.
And I'll tell people what I remember, and then you can tell me where it all went from there.
Yeah.
The gimp in the loft. No, I'm joking. You was the annoying little brother of a friend of mine in the loft, but I always found you entertaining. He always wanted to get rid of you, probably because you was funnier than him.
Yeah, maybe.
But obviously, all I remember is the lad that played Call of Duty and told me he was going to go in the army because he played Call of Duty. And fair play to you, mate. You went through with it, you done it, and now you've got the stories to tell, hopefully.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say that was the only reason playing Call of Duty. I think growing up, if you spoke to my mum, she'd probably say that I was always going to join the army. And that was probably because I used to, keep my room really clean, fold my clothes. I was very, pedantic and stuck to the rules. Obviously, broke them and bent them quite a lot as well at the same time, but only for what I could get away with. She'd always said that I'd either be a criminal or I'd join the army.
It's a fine line between the two, probably.
Yeah. I mean, there's probably not much difference, I guess. it just, at the end of school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do anyway. So I guess I went with my best friend, Darren, at the time. Still is my best friend as well, in case he's listening. And he went through it with it straight from school, signed up, joined the infantry, fusiliers. But my dad, wouldn't give me permission to join. So he said that to go to college, think about it, and then after college, when I'm 18, I can do what I want anyway. So kind of wasted 2 years at college doing nothing, messing around, and then eventually signed up. Went and sat all my tests, because I obviously originally wanted to join infantry as well with my friend. Not specifically what he joined, though. I think that was a bit weird. I don't know why he joined that division. It was a bit random. He always said he wanted to, jump out of planes and be behind enemy lines, and for some reason that was the first thing he joined, was the Fusiliers. He eventually ended up doing the paras himself. But, went and sat my tests at Army Recruitment Centre, which was in Ilford at the time.
Yeah.
Not there anymore. Closed it down because they got a mail bomb in the post.
I remember reading this.
So they had to close it down eventually because they were getting a lot of...
Cranbrook Road or something like that, wasn't it? Down the end, towards the park. I remember that.
Raphael's Park, yeah.
Yeah.
So we used to run around there to warm up and practice and stuff, I guess, for selection and stuff. Went in there, set the test. And infantry was obviously the first thing in my mind. But then when he gave me the sheet of what I could join, which was like 5 pages long, I sort of looked more into that. And then I had down actually Intelligence Corps as one of my options. And Royal Engineers was another option, which I eventually obviously joined. I did put down for dog handling as well, because I thought that would be quite an interesting thing.
Got to go and find all the bombs.
Yeah.
I suppose that's what they've got to do a lot of the time.
I'm not sure. Well, the Royal Engineers, it's part of their job to obviously valor the areas and do your minesweeping and stuff like that. I'm not really too sure what dog handling involved in general. I just like the idea of
having a dog. Having a pet while you're away.
I didn't really read much into that one. The Intelligence Corps was the one I really wanted, because I specifically wanted to join and be an interrogation specialist, because I thought it'd be interesting to sort of dive into the psychology of someone's mind and seeing how you can unwrap and get information out of people that they don't want to give up. So that was one I was really pining for. I think at the time there was a wait list for that, and it was 2 years long, so I was just I just want to get in and do it now. So went from there to selection. selection was actually, where was mine? I think it was down in Purbright, which is a training area in Surrey. Did my tests. They were easier than I thought. They was always telling you, oh, you have to do this, you have to do this 10:30 minimum, 50 press-ups, 50 push-ups.
Yeah, so I was going to say, what's involved in a test? What would be the run-through?
So for selection, I eventually found out that they would accept you if you did a sub-13-minute mile-and-a-half run, and if you did 25 push-ups and 25 sit-ups, they would accept you. But the actual standard fitness test that they do in the army and test you every year is sub-10.5 minutes, 50 press-ups and 50 sit-ups, which in itself isn't all that much anyway. I mean, it probably sounds a lot to someone who's just
Adam McDonald's
out.
Like me. Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds awful to me, but yeah, go on.
But yeah, like, you'd be surprised how quickly you can move, like, when it's best effort, and how much push-ups and sit-ups you can smash out when you're just doing it to better yourself, really, I guess. So yeah, I went down there, passed all of that, and then I got my join date, which was 2013, January. And yeah, from there I went to Alexandra Barracks, which was a basic training.
Whereabouts is that?
That's in Surrey as well.
Okay.
I can't remember specifically where it is now. Like Aldershot
right,
area.
Okay, yep.
And then you're there then for 3 months, basic infantry.
And what's that like when you arrive? Obviously, guessing, did you know anybody that you'd been put with? Because obviously, I'm guessing you do training, you might see faces that get selected as well, do you? Or not?
Yeah, so you do. Before I joined, I went obviously selection, and then you meet people down there, but a lot of them are joining different areas of the army, I guess. If you're joining infantry, then you go up to Catterick in North Yorkshire, and a lot of people just want to join infantry because, as you said, like Call of Duty was the big thing.
Give me the gun.
Yeah. So where I went, Alexandra Barracks is for your sort of cap badges and your what's the word I'm looking for? Actual jobs within the army, I guess.
Like a distinctive role.
Yeah.
Like where you need extended training, I'm guessing.
Yeah, so everyone from like RLC, which is your driving and your logistics, to intelligence corps down there as well, Royal Engineers, chefs, just everyone that's not infantry will go to Alexandra Barracks for their basic training. And as I said, yeah, in my selection, pretty much all of them wanted to join the infantry. So I didn't know anyone on that day that I arrived. And there was, 14 people per section. And there was two trainings running at the same time. So there was about 100 people, 120 people that showed up that day. Obviously, you show up in a suit, where everyone's told to wear a suit and tie. And you go, first thing you do is you go to the auditorium, and you all sit down in the auditorium and they hand out your military contract. And then you spend about 2 hours in there talking about what you're signing and the specifics of what you're entitled to and stuff. Because when you sign up, you've got four options, right? So you can either do a long contract tied in for 24 years, and that means you serve 24 years and, you know, there's no way of sort of breaking that, obviously, unless that you get injured or discharged through medical grounds. Then you have versatile engagement contracts, and you can choose to sign up for 12 or 24. And that means you have to serve a minimum of 4, and then you have to give a year's notice if you want to leave. So obviously they get you in there and there's 4 boxes to tick. So it's 24, 12 fixed, 24, 12 versatile. And they sort of explain everything else. And then they give you the rest of the day, really, to sit there and think about it.
It's a big decision, essentially, to be making, I suppose. It doesn't seem like long enough in that sense.
It is, but I think a lot of people from selection, because my before I joined, I had to actually have a nose operation because I had a collapsed septum and they wouldn't actually accept me with a collapsed septum. So my wait time, really, from the moment I walked into the recruitment office was about 9 months. So you've got 9 months there where you're thinking, do I want to do it? A lot of people obviously pull out in between. Like, I know plenty of people from school that went to a recruitment centre and did all the tests and just said, nah, not for me.
Hmm.
And even still, like, if you do sign the contract, they say in the first 2 weeks, you know, you can leave at any time. Like, get a bit of taste for it, and if you don't like it, you
mental
can...
14-day calling off period.
Yeah. And then they have you. They say, right, you get 2 weeks and you can leave at any time. Then at that 2 week point, I think it's 6 weeks, we have you for 6 weeks no matter what. Obviously, I guess if you are really struggling, then they'll probably pull you out. But they say to you, like, 6 weeks no matter what, we'll keep you. And then at that 6 week point, you can say, right, nah, this wasn't for me. Like, and they give you that one day to sort of say, nah, I want out. And then that's your opportunity then to break your contract. So yeah, I think on the day, I remember 3 people actually walked out and said, nah, like, I kind of been forced into this. My parents wanted me to do something. I didn't really want to do this. Like, I'm not signing it. And they left on that spot. My decision was pretty quick and clear, I think. I signed a 12-year versatile because they offer you, like, an extension at the end of that anyway. So logically, I was just like, well, I don't want to sign something fixed for 12, 24 years. Like, I'm not even sure if I want to do this for the rest of my life. Mm. So a 12 just seemed like...
Is there any money difference?
No.
So there's no reward for signing up 24 years straight?
No, the only thing is that you're tied in. So if you have a 12-year fix, then what happens is, I think if you get injured and you get discharged, then they have to honour the rest of that contract. So you'll get some sort of, like, war pension paid out,
okay.
They refer to it as. If it's a versatile, then they only... I think they still pay out the contract. It depends on the severity of your injury, I guess. But there's a lot more, I guess... non-guarantees, and they can also at the 12-year point just reject you and say, no, we're not offering you a further 12 years. So I guess it's like a guarantee that you're going to stay in.
Yeah. What was your thought process when you saw 2 people just instantly stand up and walk out? Did you think, oh, have I missed something? Or did you just...
I didn't notice.
So focused.
To be honest with you, I didn't notice the first one because I was too busy actually reading my contract.
Clever.
The person to the left and right of me, like, one of them signed like 15 minutes into the talk, and I sort of like looked at him. I was like, yeah, all right. Okay. And then the other guy waited until the end of it, and he's just like, yeah, right, I know what I'm doing. And then they signed it, and then I sort of just sat there and I read a little bit of the sort of terms and conditions and things like that, just to make sure that, you know, I haven't been duped or the guy hasn't said something and it actually meant something else. But yeah, I was probably in there for about 30 to 40 minutes actually reading some of the stuff. But I didn't really hesitate at all. Yeah, when I saw the first one that went out, it was pretty much straight away. The second one, I sort of looked, and you could see that, he was just, he didn't look like he was really all that into it. The third one was a bit sort of emotional because he was like, he looked like it was about to cry, and I think he did outside. Like,
sort of. Yeah, I suppose the pressure of feeling like he's let someone down, or I just look at it from how I would feel is I've got that far, and now I've got to go back and tell everyone I've changed my mind. Like, there's a big pressure there, isn't there, to be like, I can't do it.
I guess, I mean, at the time, I was probably thinking, you know.
Yeah, don't be a...
What a wuss. You come all this way.
Yeah, exactly. What's the point, like, mate? You put a suit on and everything.
And your parents have now got to come.
Come pick you up. You're an embarrassment. Yeah,
no,
but I get it.
Yeah, I get it as well. Like, it was a big decision. And yeah, I guess because I've always wanted to do it. It's just,
I suppose it's at that point shit gets real, to the point where you've got someone explaining a contract going through it of you, and actually I should imagine there's bits in there they're talking about what can go wrong as well. I suppose they've got to cover those areas, or did they not?
No, not specifically. I mean, like they said, like they made reference to it, of course, but like they didn't specifically like show you a slideshow of someone's like leg being blown off or anything like that. It was just kind of like, you know, when you sign this contract, you're entering like a very serious deal, essentially, and that you can't. It's not as easy as like having a paper out and just quitting. Like you can't just walk out. You're committing to like a good portion of your life. And do you really want to do that? Because it's not just a job; it's a lifestyle.
Yeah.
And there's obviously things that you're going to miss out on and sacrifice as a result. Which a lot of people, I think, on Civvy Street don't realise. Like, you are sacrificing a lot of your...
youth,
essentially. Yeah, youth, but, like, just how you don't have freedom. You're effectively a slave to the crown at that point. It is a big decision, but, yeah, because it's something I always wanted to do. It never really fazed me when I saw people walking out and other people sort of flustering. But yeah, no, signed that 12-year versatile engagement and quite happy with that. And then you're outside after that and everyone's talking. You're telling them what you signed and they're telling you what they signed. And then I remember speaking to one guy and he was like, yeah, I signed a 24 fix. And I was like, oh, I was like, that's a bit brave, isn't it? And he was just like, oh, yeah, you know, well, I'm in this for life now. And I was just like, yeah, you're saying that now. I was like, what about in 5 years' time? Yeah. I was like, don't you want that, like, you know, bit of freedom?
Yeah, exactly. It's nice to have a little bit of negotiation in a contract, isn't
there? Yeah, and nah, he seems pretty adamant. He, ironically, I think that guy has left now. he actually left about 3 years in. He sort of claimed like mental health issues and got medically discharged, but we know that he used that system to get discharged. He wasn't suffering. He just regretted his decision. Yeah, exactly. And wanted to leave.
Note to self.
Yeah.
But then I should imagine like, well, you can tell me. There's a lot of bravado. Like you got all these.
Initially,
sort of personalities coming together. Are you all signing up for the first day? Is it like, well, I've done a 24-year? Like, is it that bravado taking over, the adrenaline of that, rather so than a
where
you,
so,
by the sounds of it, you sat there and you was very calculated in your thought process, very calm, and signed.
I think
differently.
I reckon because for the weeks to come after that, you definitely have. I mean, basic training is good because it sort of at the time that I come through anyway. It sort of beats you down and puts you all on the same level. But certainly in the first couple of weeks, you've got people that resist, who think they're bigger than what they are. And it is interesting to watch those sort of egos get squashed over time. But yeah, no, that's your first day. And then from there, you'll go to get your kit issued. You'll get all your kit issued. They'll take you to your bunk. You'll get your bed, and then they march you down and shave your head.
Really, everyone's compulsory. Yeah,
compulsory. I thought it was funny because we had a few bald people there, and they still had to have their head shaved. And you're just like, there's nothing left. It's like, what more can you take?
Is there any reason for that? Is it hygiene or is it purely just to bring everybody to the same?
Yeah, I think both, really, because I think it's knits is a big thing.
Oh, okay.
So right. I think they do it initially for hygiene, but it's also you want everyone the same. You want everyone uniform and you want no sort of... they don't want you to have an identity. They want to like factory reset you into and then mold you into a soldier. So I'm not sure. The women don't obviously have to have their head shaved. If there's any women listeners that want to join the army, don't worry, you don't have to have your head shaved. But yeah, certainly all the men will have a one buzz cut. And if the women would then have their hair tied up in a bun, slick back. Yeah, it's just to get everyone the same, I think. Yeah. Just to sort of remind you all that, you know, no one's bigger than anyone else. We're all here.
How long did it sort of take for that to all level itself out, for friendship groups to form? Like, because obviously everyone, you hear people talk that they meet people, they become family essentially in their mindset because they've been through a lot with them. I know my brother, because my middle brother was in the French Foreign Legion, and I know he talks, even at his age now, he talks of his friends probably more lovingly than he talks about any of his family. Does that take a lot? Does that happen quite quick because you're going through that training process, or does that come later?
It does form over time, I think. And it's with everyone. Like, I still remember everyone that was in my room by name. And I think it's because you're all there together going through the same hardships together that it brings you... It's time spent as well. I feel like if you meet someone on a night out, or if you meet someone for the first time, and you got an hour of exposure to them, and you just go, "No, I'm sick of you. I'm never going to talk to you again." But there, that isn't the case. You spend 24/7, you know, together. So you're forced to interact with each other. And then at certain points, you get to a point where you obviously find common ground with each other. Because there was people that I met on the first day, and I was just like, "I'm never going to talk to you. You're an absolute idiot."
You didn't tolerate fools. Like, from my memory, if anyone was talking fart, you'd call them out instantly. Like, you always had that about you, that you wouldn't...
Yeah.
You wouldn't have anyone sort of question your intelligence in trying to say anything to you that you didn't believe was factual or true, would you?
No. So those sort of people, and even to this day, like, I don't know what the need is for people to come into a room and try to, like, oversell themselves and, like, impress themselves. Like, this isn't like a job interview. Like, I don't really want to hear you know, brag about things that you didn't do, or embellish things that aren't all that true. And I guess I sort of initially avoided those people when I joined, because you did have those ones that were like, "Yeah, I'm from the streets."
Yeah, I'm gonna say, I just imagine it being an environment where you've got that. So just like, did that teach you how to deal with those individuals in a different way, rather than... Probably the way I remember was sarcasm, which was very funny. But
I guess I was. Like, I just sort of sarcastically just sort of agreed with them and, shut them down, I guess. But I didn't really have to do much because the instructors are there to do that.
Right, okay.
That's their whole point. Like, if someone starts back-chatting or anything like that, you just find yourself doing push-ups, or, you know, you're on the brass line having to make sure all your clothes are ironed for it. And, you didn't really have to... have that conflict with them. They eventually sort of conformed, or they got evicted, essentially.
Right, okay.
So basic training was... It was an eye-opener as such, because then you'd have people... I remember the first week we was getting all of our stuff together, ironing all of our clothes, sorting out our lockers and things like that. And there was this one guy in particular who's just like really struggling. And I remember on the first day, our full screw come in. His name was Corporal M. Beniswa.
And, it's a mouthful.
he was funny. He said MB for short was fine. But he was a funny, funny guy. And he'd come in and he'd always greet you, be like, "Good morning, dickheads." And he's like, "Oh, good morning, Corporal." And he said, one of the first things he said was that, you know, you're all in this together. And just to remember, like, that you move as one. And I sort of read into that and was just like, right, he's trying to tell me, like, I need to help everyone else. If I'm doing well, I need to help them. So I remember helping this guy iron his clothes and sort his locker out and everything like that. And he was like, "Oh, I want to leave. And I was like, no, it's fine. Like, it's just the first week. It's a shock to the system. Like, it'll be fine. And got his locker sorted, everything. And then he seemed quite happy. And then he went sick one day, and I was just like, oh, he's gone sick. You know, we'll see him tomorrow. And he had said to me before, like, oh, you know, thanks for helping me out, everything like that. Like, I think I was just having a weak moment. And I was just like, all right, we got him. And then I stayed up to like 3 o'clock in the morning actually helping him do all this. And then he goes sick. And then I find out that he pulled out. And I was just like, oh, you son of a
wasted
bitch.
Wasted all my time.
Yeah. I was like, I stay out till three. And then, like, one of the guys there, Shaquille, went to me. He's like, oh, I bet you regret doing that now. And I was just like, well, not really, because, like, you can only try, can't you?
Exactly.
Like, I tried to get him to stay. And, yeah, it's a good thing he did, because, as I said before, they keep for those first 2 weeks. So they're a bit sort of standoffish and not as aggressive or anything like that. They try and make it seem a bit nicer. And then the next morning, yeah, it completely changes.
Day 21.
Yeah, yeah. Beds are getting flipped. Like, all your lockers getting pulled out, thrown on the floor. They're making you do, like, you know, 800 meter runs just to warm up.
Is there a reason for it? Are they trying to get a reaction? Are they trying to just see, are you coping that scenario? What? Or is it punishment? Yeah. Or is it because someone's not told a line? Like,
I think it's trying to see where your limit is and whether you're going to push through that to obviously achieve the goal. Because everyone that joins obviously has the goal of serving and being a soldier. So they're trying to mess with you psychologically, physically. Can you tolerate the stresses I'm giving you? Because if you can't handle me coming into your room of a morning, flipping your perfectly made bed that's taken you 15 minutes to make, you know, if you can't handle me making you do 50 push-ups because there's a bit of moisture left on your toothbrush, then how are you going to deal with bullets flying above your head and, you know, your friend's leg's just been blown off and you have to drag him to an evacuation point? Like, how are you going to possibly deal with that if you can't deal with these minor things? So I guess it's all a game, I guess, to try and see if they can break you, and if they can't, then you go on to the next phase, and then they try and break you, and then
just a comparable. So yeah. What did you have any moment where you thought, oh, do I want to do this anymore? Or what did you, I wouldn't say, I'm sure, imagine you had hard days, but was there a point where you thought, they're close to breaking me at that training side?
Not in the basic training. So basic training was fine for me. I kind of understood at times, this is just a game. Like, they just want to fuck with you. Like, this isn't what it's going to be like forever and ever. And I did obviously have a friend in the army already, and he said the same thing. Look, it's just a mess around. Like, just play the game.
Yep.
Get through basic training, and it'll get easier. And then you'll go to your next phase. And then once you get into the field army, eventually, you know, it's not the same. So, yeah, during the army, during the basic training and the training following on for that, I didn't have a day. The worst day I can think of was 5 years in. And I went on a promotion course. So in order to get promoted, you have to do a thing called a CADA. And we did this in Wales, in the Brecon Beacons. And we did it over the wettest week. They scheduled it on purpose for that. So it was the wettest week of the year in Wales, Brecon Beacons, which, if you speak to anyone, that's just like its own weather system. And I remember the day we stepped off the coach. Drove the coach down there from obviously the training camp, and sunny, beautiful weather. The second we stepped off the coach, it started to rain.
And they pushed the button.
Yeah, and it did not stop raining until the day we finished and we was going to step back onto the coach. And it was that bad that all my hands had swollen, and because of all the moisture and the coldness. Because it was like minus, you know, 6-7 wind chill, and it got to the point where if I clenched my fist, all of like old scars that I had on my hands would just break. But yeah, it was that particular day. So we do a thing usually when we go on to exercise. That's what we call exercise, pretending to be soldiers, basically. We do something called an insurgent's tap, which is basically your first march of the exercise. Now, we did this over something called Penny Fan. So it was about 8 miles. And then we did Penny Fan. And then at the end of that, we then marched to the tree line where we was going to stay and rest our heads. Now, usually these tree lines are quite guarded and shielded, and it sort of blocks a lot of the rain and stuff. But for some reason, the one they took us to looked like they'd shaved all the bloody branches off. So it was just absolutely hammering it down. We'd just done about 12 miles. I was soaked. Everyone was soaked. And you usually get paired up with a basher buddy. And obviously you dig your little hole and you set your little camp up. And the guy I got partnered with, it was an older guy, but he was pretty useless. And I was just like, oh, great. And he started putting up the poncho and he got a bungee cord, put it in one end, and then he went round the tree, put it in the other end, and then it just unhooked itself, splang around the tree, and then just smacked me square in the face. And like the way he'd put it up, like he'd done that, obviously not on purpose, but anyone putting up a poncho would know that you shouldn't have done what you'd done, because that was always going to happen. So at that point, I just sat on the floor in the pouring rain, and I just sort of like looked out, and I was just like, this is it. This is my breaking point. And then I sort of just sat there for 5 minutes. I used to take 2 chocolate bars with me, one for emergencies and then one for the end. And yeah, I cracked my emergency one on day one. I had that, and then I was just like, right, yeah, new lease of life. Dig my hole, set up the poncho, get everything sorted, and do your wet and dry drills. But yeah, no, that was probably the closest I come to breaking. But it was like
all it was a bungee cord.
That was the straw that broke the camel's back. Yeah,
so brilliant. So moving on from there. What was your sort of next process in terms of your direction of where you ended up? So you finish obviously basic training.
Yes, I did.
And the advanced.
You do your 3 months basic training, and then for me, because I joined the Royal Engineers in the end, I then go on to engineer, basic engineering, and that's where you learn to be a combat engineer. So that's sort of field fortifications, watermanship, so clean supply of water. Minefield clearing, if you're artisan trades, you learn sort of basic sort of general like construction sort of stuff, I guess. There's loads of things, bridge building, it's everything you need to do to be a combat engineer, which is again 12 weeks from there. And then obviously you then go on to be what you've chosen. So for me, I chose to be a plant operator. So then my next stop from there was to go to Leckenfield in Hull and do my driver training. So you learn how to obviously drive a car if you haven't already done so. You then go do your C and C&E license, which is your articulated lorries. Yep. And then after you've done your driver's training, you then go on to do your chosen topic. So my plant operating was down in Chatham, Kent. So I was there for I think 9 months ish, and then you basically just do an MVQ in plant operating. Once you've done all of that, that's when you then select options of where you want to go to. So I ended up going to 2-3 Power Regiment, which is up in Woodbridge. It wasn't my first choice.
What was the first choice?
So I had initially put down 101, which was bomb disposal.
Okay.
And what had happened was, is I'd got bomb disposal. I knew I wanted to go to a specialist place just to try it. But I didn't want to go there, 2-3 or 2-4 specifically, which is power regiment and commandos. That was always something I wanted to try further down the line. I wanted to first go and do 101 bomb disposal, which I did get, and that was in Colchester. But there was a guy who was from Colchester, and he had a few kids, and I was like, and I can't remember which one he got. He got Kinloss, I think, which is all the way up in Scotland. No one wants to get Kinloss. Like, it's to get to Scotland, it's what, a 12-hour drive, but then when you're there in Scotland on the border, it's another 8 hours to get to Kinloss.
Right, so just because right at the top,
because yeah, it just winds through all the mountains and it's the arse end of nowhere. No one wants to go there. They even give you every second week a long weekend as like an incentive to go up there. And it's become some sort of like a army sports hub to try and convince people to go up there because no one wants to go there. So anyway, he got that and I was like, oh, I feel a bit bad because I did say I want to do 2-3 or 2-4 because if you volunteer for those, you get them like no matter what. And he didn't want to do that. So I said, look, I'll swap my Kinloss for your my 101 for your Kinloss, and then I'll just volunteer to do 2-3 to get out of going to Kinloss, basically. And I had a friend there anyway at 2-3. So I was like, you know, I'll just tackle this a bit earlier than expected. So we swapped. I went to 2-3 in Ipswich. I don't know. I didn't really enjoy my time there because the thing is with 2-3 and 2-4, it's a very tribal mentality there. Like, even though you're in the army, you're not in their army until you've done the P company course. Now that's something that I tried the first time and I got a meniscus tear in my cartilage and my knee, and that was before I'd even got up to P company, and it took about 6 months for that to heal. And then it was always a problem whenever, because as you know, cartilage tears don't fully heal. They always stay as a problem. And then again, my logic sort of set in when the doctor sort of said, look, you can do it. And you could, it's not a worry, this pain you're feeling, you can push through that and that's fine. But in 15 years' time, you're going to feel it in your knee and your knees are going to give way and you're not going to have that kind of freedom of movement that you have now. And that's just your knee. Like, anything else can go because you're in pain all the time. So he sort of said, like, I'd probably recommend not pursuing a specialist unit because it's going to be full on all the time. And if you're planning on moving about once you finish your army career, then yeah, you probably would not choose this currently because your body's just not conditioned for it. So I sort of took that and was like, well, I'm going to listen to him because he knows what he's talking about. And I decided to then, if you don't obviously do your course in the first year, then they look to move you on to a different unit. So I went eventually to 2-2 Engineer Regiment, which is over in Salisbury. So I ended up there for the rest of my career then. Which I enjoyed. Yeah. It was very different because obviously when I went to 2-3, everyone was just like, yeah, I'm not talking to you. they have like all these rules about, because their colour is maroon.
Right.
And obviously if you pass the course, you get your maroon beret, you get your wings and everything like that. It's like obviously a big thing, huge thing. And they kind of like, try and make you feel excluded so that you want to get into the club.
Yeah, gotcha.
But it kind of like then gets to the point where, well, certainly for me, because I always have had like a social problem and integrating with people. And that's just because I've got Asperger's. So it's hard for me to like develop relationships quickly with people. I need to spend time because I need to learn the social sort of economics of a person before I can develop a relationship with them. So because they're always trying to exclude you because you didn't pass the course or you're not one of them, it then made it hard to want to stay, I guess, as well. So when they sort of said, like, you know, gave me this sort of out with the knee, I was just like, well, you know.
Yep. See ya.
Yeah. And then not only that, my friend that was there, he had also just recently been discharged for diabetes. So I was just like, well, he was probably the only one that I was
therefore
talking to regularly as well. So I was like, yeah, I might as well just go and enjoy whatever career I've got left down there. So yeah, so I left, went to Tidworth, which is near Salisbury Plain.
Yep.
And then I spent another 3 years there because I did 7 years altogether.
Oh yeah, I was going to say, how long did you do in Italy?
Yeah, 7 years. I did, whilst I was at Tidworth, it was a lot better because obviously I went there, everyone sort of was just like, oh, you know, new person, friends. And it was easier to sort of like fit in and
build those relationships.
Yeah. And then also because I wasn't trying to do a course to then be part of the group, I could then go and do other things. So I did, you know, like skiing trips, went to Canada. Well, I wasn't very long in Canada.
sounds like there's some reason why.
Yeah. So Canada, we went to, I was going to go over there and be a part of permanent staff. So it's basically a massive training area over there, which is BATIS. So it's British Army Training Unit over there. And basically that is where they pretend to be soldiers, but like on a larger scale. So they have like their tanks over there and everything like that. So my job over there would have essentially have been backfilling holes that tanks were just blown.
Couldn't fancy that.
Well, no, I did. Like, I wanted to go, so I flew over there. It was a 12-hour flight. I landed on Friday, unpacked, got all of our room ready. Then we went to the pub. Everything was fine. On the Saturday, again, not much to do. Went around, done all my jobs, trying to like buy a car and stuff because this camp was obviously in the middle of nowhere in Canada. So yeah, I was like proper setting up, ready to go. And then on that Saturday, we went to the pub on camp, and we was all on this punching bag machine. And unbeknownst to me, behind the punching bag machine, the threads were sort of wearing away. And it was close to completely just ripping open. So we're there punching it as hard as we can, obviously not knowing that. And the thing that annoys me as well is because I beat the score. And when you beat the score, you get to have another go. So I was, at that point, I was like, well, I've won. You know, if someone wants to try and beat the score, you can go and you beat your score. But I was like 3 points off of like 900. And one of the lads was there and we were obviously all pissed off and he was just like, yeah, you got to beat 900, don't you? I was like, we can't beat you, but, you know, you can beat 900.
The computer can.
And I was just like, okay. So I was like, right, I'll beat 900 and that's it. So swung as hard as I could. And then as I've hit the bag split, the sack inside has obviously burst and inside is a metal arm. So I've punched basically just a metal arm as hard as I possibly could. And I think I only got a score of like 3 because it didn't connect with the sensor at the back. And I was just like, oh, that was a bit solid, that. And I've sat back down. I've looked at my hand and I've seen the lump. And I've gone, oh, God, what's that? And this is how drunk I was at the time. I was just like, oh, it's just my knuckles dislocated. I'll just push that back into place. And I was just But obviously, in hindsight, you can't dislocate a knuckle. It's part of the bone. So what had happened is I'd snapped my third metal carpal completely in the middle. So I had to go and get a scan in Canada and then come back to camp. On Sunday, I was just called up the guy. I was just like, I've broke my hand. And he was just like, oh, great. Because I was meant to be in Canada for 6 months.
Right.
So he was a bit annoyed.
Lasted 6 days.
Yeah, and then so they sent me home. So I got on a plane on the Monday. So I was in Canada.
Didn't even make 6 days.
So I was in Canada for 4 days. Ironically, I spent more time traveling than I did actually in Canada.
In Canada.
But yeah, come back here and they fixed it up. And it was, yeah.
Yeah. So in that 7 years, any tours?
Yes, so before the whole Canada fiasco, we did go to Iraq. Yeah. So at the time, so this was 2016, and we was obviously pulled out at that point of Iraq and Afghan. And then obviously it was announced that we was going back in to help with the ISIS problem. And the role over there was to be of that of training. So we would train the Iraqi National Army to go fight the insurgents just north of where we were. But at the time, we was training to go to Kenya.
Kenya.
So we were the only engineer unit that was like ready to go. Because obviously it was ready to go to Kenya. Because our role over there was just going to be construction, and we were just going to rebuild the old camp that had been overrun when we obviously vacated that camp. So we went around September of 2016. I was there for 6 months in Iraq building a camp, Al Asad Air Base.
Okay. So when you got that call...
Yep.
So, right, we're not going to Kenya, we're going to Iraq. Was there adrenaline, excitement?
I think everyone was excited, yeah, because that's what you joined to do.
Yeah, exactly. So you get to use those, hopefully use some of these tools that they've taught you.
Yeah, I mean, as much as people don't, you don't want to be taking someone's life and all that sort of stuff, but you do want to go and experience the stuff that no one else is going to experience. That for me was the biggest thing, was that I was going to go to Iraq. It's going to be a war zone. It's going to be something that no one else is ever going to experience in their life. It was just fascinating to go. So when they sort of said, oh, we're going to Iraq now, I was like, yes, sweet, brilliant, bring it on.
What was the arrival like? Bit of adrenaline, not knowing what you're going into, or...
I actually had to arrive a week later because just before I was due to go, I dislocated my shoulder.
No punch bag in sight this time, hopefully.
No, this was an issue with just one of the PT sessions. So I'd basically, it was raining and we was doing something we wasn't meant to be doing because of the rain. And I'd slipped doing bear crawls and... just landed awkwardly and my shoulder popped out. But that was like 4 days before flight. So what happened was I just then got put on the back shift or the backfill just so they could pop my shoulder back in and then I can go out there and do my recovery there. Because it's when you dislocate your shoulder, it's just about giving it some time to heal. Yeah. And it's not major. So you fly from Bryce Norton here in the UK to Cyprus, and that's on a Voyager, which is basically just like a commercial airline in a way.
Yep.
And then in Cyprus, you then transfer onto a C-13, which is obviously your military plane. Obviously, very different.
Yep.
Is
it like what it says on the films, all sat there on the floor, or is it
yeah,
quite like that?
Yeah. It's not like seats. The way to describe it is the seatbelt seats.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Like cargo netting.
Yeah.
And you'll obviously get on with all your kit that you're going to be there with. And then we had to land first in Baghdad because we was there not as a fighting force, as a diplomatic support.
Right.
So we had to land there first, get our passport stamped, and then we had to fly to Al Asad Air Base. So as we're coming in, you get the call, and you can't hear anything. You have to sit there the whole time with ear defenders on because there's obviously no sort of insulation from the outside. Mm. You can just hear the engines. It's loud as you can't have a conversation on there at all. But you get the call that you're about to land, and then you have to put on your helmet and body armor because obviously people probably try and take pot shots at you as you're landing. And I kind of thought, well, if I'm getting shot down in a plane, this helmet and body armor is not going to be any use to me, is it? But yeah, no, they said it's just for people with idle firearms just shooting at planes as they land, especially like military ones. So yeah, you land, declare, I've got X amount of soldiers on this plane and we've got X amount of firearms as such. And then you fly off to Al Asad air base, which was just an air base in the middle of nowhere, just literally desert for miles around.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's everything you see in these like films, really. Like Jarhead, for example. Like that's a good comparison as to what it was, just complete barren desert. But it's, I don't know. You do obviously get the excitement because you've just landed there, but then quite quickly you kind of like, nothing's going on. Like, I might as well just be at home at this point. Like, there's nothing really going on.
Too much threat?
There is a threat. There's obviously always a threat. So where we were was one of the closest camps to where the threat was, which was obviously in Mosul at the time. And we had been told in our briefings before we went there that the camp that we was going to had just recently in the last 3 months been attacked. And there was like gas attacks and things like that. And there's always like an IDF threat. Where they just shoot rockets at you just to see if it's anyone. So we kind of landed with this whole idea that, oh, you know, we're going to get a lot of people trying to, like, kick us out of this camp. But I think of the 6 months that I was there, there was 5 alarms that went off for IDF. So if you hear the alarm, you went to, you know, hit the floor and then try and find a fallout bunker to go and sit in. And that was only 5 times that we was there. And when I say a threat of IDF, it's kind of like throwing a ping pong at a goal.
Right.
Like, that's essentially what they're doing with a rocket. They're trying to hit you in the goal from miles away. Like, the likelihood of you being hit is pretty slim. In fact, the funniest thing is that the whole time we was there, the biggest threat or the most dangerous night that we had was because there was American forces there and they had a specialist unit there at the time. And they were down the ammo dump. Don't know what they were doing down there. but
ask no questions.
I'm assuming that they were doing, you know, just, I don't know if they were just, yeah, God knows what was happening down there. Because what had happened was they'd accidentally set fire to the ammo dump. And as you can imagine, you know, that's not what you want to set fire to. So there's all of a sudden you sat there and you're hearing like rounds going off in the distance and you're like, what is going on? And then you're hearing like explosions and things like that. And you're like, what is going on? And then we got told that obviously the ammo dump's on fire, you know, put your helmets and body armor on. And then we just sort of sat there waiting because obviously there's mortar rounds there. There's all sorts down there. And you don't know if that's going to, you know, go off and land in your bed. So that was for about 5-6 hours. That was on fire. and we were just sleeping in our helmets and body armors just because these Americans had just set fire to it by accident.
Sounds very American.
Yeah. It turned out that they had daisy chained extension cords, and they were charging their phones and power banks. And it caused an electrical fire, set fire to everything. And
ladies and gentlemen, they are our allies.
Yeah. So that was most dangerous night was friendly fire. But no, there wasn't much, nothing. When I was there for the 6 months, there wasn't like any sort of threat towards us. I mean, the infantry that was there training the Iraqi army, they'd always say like you'd train a group of people and then they'd be sent off to go and fight ISIS. And then, you know, they'd come back a few weeks later and they'd see, you know, a third of them missing. And they'd be like, oh, okay, I'm guessing.
Yeah, two and two together.
They're teetotal.
Yeah.
One of my friends was on guard at the time. Another funny story is that so the infantry was doing guard rotation on camp. And they kept getting sent home because of silly things that they were doing. And one of the silly things, for example, that they were doing is because we shared the rotation with the Americans that was there and the Danish, is that they would have like banter, I guess, with the Americans. But they don't do it the same way that we do. So an example of this is one of the lads wrote on a polystyrene cup. Drew a picture of the Twin Towers and a plane and said like haha 9/11 or something like that.
Jesus Christ.
So obviously it's a bit too far, and he obviously got reported and sent home. So because so many of the infantry were getting sent home for doing stupid things like that, we then had to start filling in their guard rotation. So one night, one of our friends went on guard, and we'd been told, you know, it's easy, like there's nothing happening. Half the camp overlooked the Iraqi side of the camp. So this whole camp used to be the American camp. And when they left and pulled out, the Iraqis who were on the side that we were on went, oh, this is all nice and built and loads of infrastructure here. We're going to move into this side. So then when we come back, we was like, oh.
You got the crap side.
We've got the crap side, so we have to rebuild it. So then half of that sort of looks at them, and then the other half of it is just looking at desert. Like, there's nothing to see. So we had always been told, yeah, it's easy. It's sort of like where we are being posted, we're being posted on the side looking at the Iraqi army, which obviously are there to support us. So there's not hardly any threat there, because then they have their fence line that they're manning or should be manning. This guy, he was the first one of us to go on the guard, and he was like, yeah, no threat. So his first night, a car comes steaming up to the front gate, and obviously they're just screaming in Arabic because something's just happened. They've radioed in, you know, like, oh, there's a car at the front gate. What's going on? You can imagine what he's like, because obviously we're not infantry, so we're not, even though we've done our basic training in this, we're not really trained for these sort of situations, I guess. So he's there like going, oh, what do I do? So what happened is one of the police officers, Iraqi police officers, whilst out on patrol, had been shot in the head, and they were coming to the camp to see if they can get medical treatment. So they'd obviously steamed in, my mate's gone down to check it out, and he said that he's opened the so it was a 4x4, so he's opened the sort of back tail, which, you know, it's like in two sections. You've got the winder and the drop. He's opened the drop, and where he had been propped up, because obviously he's dead at this point, he got shot straight through the head. The exit wound is where he sort of landed his head back, like the body, and like the brain sort of come out.
Oh, and nice.
all of like the the fluids and stuff to go with it sort of splashed over him. And yeah, so that was his first night on guard.
On guard on something that nothing ever happens.
Nothing ever happens, yeah.
Probably nothing ever did happen.
And I remember waking up and seeing him in the morning. Like, none of us had known what had gone on. And he's just there smoking a cigarette. And you're like, looking like he's just seen a ghost. And you're like,
you're right, mate? Yeah, I'm going to say, that's the side of things people don't... I suppose you don't know how you're going to be able to handle that until it happens,
yeah.
So would you say the toughest thing you had to handle, personally?
I guess there's always something, because obviously you'd see, we're not actually there fighting, but you would see the sort of devastation left behind from the conflict that was going on. Yeah. So you would see sort of dead bodies and stuff. And I guess it's always very eerie because there's a different feeling from seeing someone that's passed naturally and in like a peaceful state to someone that's had their life taken.
Yeah.
Because there's always that like a look of shock and fear on the face. So I guess that's kind of a tough thing to sort of wrap your head around because I guess you're just not used to it, because you from before when I joined I'd seen also my great granddad, because that was open casket, and it kind of, you know, you look at him and you're like, oh, he's just sleeping, he looks peaceful, natural. And then the first body I saw out there, it's, you know, eyes wide open, mouth's open, looks like his breath's been, like, drawn from him rather than passing his last breath. So I think that side of things is the toughest thing that I've dealt with. But as I said, it wasn't an active tour, even though, you know, we was in a war zone. There wasn't a war that we was fighting. I know some people go there and they try and dress it up. They're like, yeah, I was in Iraq, you know.
Yeah.
I was fighting every day. It's just like, no, it's not. It's really not as dangerous as it sounds sometimes. But
I should imagine everybody, if they needed a team there to be fighting, it would be, like you said, it would be that team that's been trained to do that, and everyone's got their roles. Like you say, it's just the pub talk, isn't it, where people sit there and be like, yeah, I've been here. You can impress the women when you get back. Oh, yeah, I've been to Iraq, you know. Yeah, just like smashed it.
Yeah, I've never really understood that, because for me, I've always felt joining the army was always to prevent loss of life. You're there to try and prevent someone else from taking someone else's life.
Yeah.
So you're a last resort. Yeah. And it shouldn't be something to be proud of or to brag about if you've had to do it. I mean, I fortunately haven't had to do that, but I never thought that that would be a glamorous thing to talk about. But some people that have been on these tours, and they have just been as easy as my mom was, they seem to get a bit of enjoyment or, I don't know, a bit of pride for saying, oh, yeah, you know, I've killed people. And it's just like, well, no, it's not. That's not how you should look at it.
No, like, it's not the way you should be there. I should imagine there's got to be some element of you've got to make sense of it. So if you're major front line, I don't know, and excuse me if I'm being rude here, in terms of the positioning that everyone gets. I know it's a dangerous situation, but if you're literally front line battling every day, I've seen some of the documentaries, for example, in like Afghanistan and things like that, where you can see the threat constantly coming to the camp at the beginning. I think when they first went out there, I remember the blokes were sitting around saying, well, I keep a tally, we have a game, because he said there's no other way logically of dealing with this. We have to turn it into something, because if we think about what is actually going on, it's impossible to do his job. And I just always, it's always stuck with me that particular documentary that they, channel went into the camp.
Yeah.
But that was like years ago when it really first started, and I think the threat was extremely high.
I'd say, yeah, because for me, those people that have been there and they have done that, they don't talk about that.
No, no, because it was a documentary.
They're not the ones that are down the pub going, yeah, I've done this, I've done that. They're generally the ones that have gone quiet, and they're kind of like, yes, I've done these horrible things, and I've done them as a like a retaliation or a prevention. It's not something that they offer up and sort of tend to brag about, because obviously I've met people that have been in those war zone situations, and I've spoken with them, so they don't freely just tell you.
Nope. And
brag about it. So quite often not, if you've met someone down the pub and they're telling you, oh, I've done this, I've done that, yeah, generally they probably haven't. They've
talking fart.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know, I guess maybe they feel a bit embarrassed that they haven't done it, I guess. Like, I don't really know what the psychology is to why they want to pretend that they are a killer.
Yeah, exactly. It's funny you said that. My brother's in the Legion.
Yeah.
My brother will tell you every funny story going of what happened in bar fights, what happened in exercise, what happened. I'm 40. He's never told me one story.
Yeah.
Of conflict. And yeah, I've seen him get the arsehole with somebody when I sort of was all out together.
Yeah.
And he caught them saying, oh, I was in the Legion, like just nicking his, and he went mental.
Yeah.
And he said it was all, he said it was disrespect to those that have fallen during his time in what he did. Like, he didn't see the funny side of somebody making like a slight joke about doing something that they hadn't done. No. So hearing you say that just backs him up completely, because I say he's my brother, and you can't get much closer than trying to get the nitty gritty, and he won't give it to you.
No.
He just won't.
Like, no, they don't.
No detail, no nothing. He'll tell you where he went. He'll tell you a funny, like I say, a funny story, but you will never get detail, ever.
I can imagine it's a very traumatic experience. Like, I know that if, for example, like what I've been through, I've never really spoken to any of my friends about what I experienced out there. Even though I offered up the story of seeing dead bodies and things, but I haven't really gone into specific details about that. And I generally don't, because it's not something that you want to relive, mm-hmm, I guess. And the most I've done, as I said, is just seen a few things that's a bit horrible. But these people have, you know, caused that through their actions. So wanting to relive that is, I'd imagine, something that they don't want to do. Conversations that I've had with people that have obviously spoken about it to us, but that's because we are there and we potentially have that to go through at the time. But yeah, as you say, like your brother probably would never tell you.
No.
What
no.
he's
And I'd never done. Push him to tell me either. You respect the fact it is what it is, and he's got to this far, he's still nuts. but love him for it, you know. It is what it is.
Yeah, that's a different thing altogether, French Foreign Legion.
He said that whoever you talk to and whatever version you get, but apparently he wanted the challenge.
Yeah.
And that he couldn't find anything within the British Army that was enough of a challenge.
Yeah.
And then you hear other family members say that the only place for him, and
maybe
I should get his opinion one day, but without the stories.
Yeah, I mean, like French Foreign Legion, like you told stories about them, and as I say, massive challenge to join that.
Yeah,
I mean,
can't imagine.
The only closest thing, or the most elitist thing, would be to join Special Forces, of course. But in terms of, it's like a mercenary army in a sense.
Well, it's prison. I think at the time, wasn't it Once Upon a Time, prison or you got one more option.
Yeah.
Going to the Legion.
You can join the Legion. Yeah.
So yeah, God knows. I don't want to know.
No.
I've been kept from that for many years because I'm the youngest.
Yeah.
But I've quite a few years. I'd like to just point that out to them.
Yeah.
So on the table, mate.
Yeah.
We've got a few bits.
Yes.
All very impressive. So this one here, and I will post a picture for those that can't see. This was your medal for tour, was it? Was that right?
Yeah, so that was the medal you get for doing your service. Obviously, you can get medals for a range of things. The most common is obviously doing service abroad, you'll get medals for. So Iraq and Syria medal, even though we didn't go into Syria. It's on there. I'll claim it. We actually had to wait almost 16 months before we got presented that.
Oh, really?
I don't know if there was a shortage in
the
funds for that one. So that's the one and only medal I got.
And this one, it says the task forces, I'm guessing because you mentioned Iraq and the Danish. So is that right?
Yeah, so this is the badge that we had to sort of differentiate our task force. So we had Americans, us from the United Kingdom, obviously, and the Danish were there, and obviously working aside the Iraqis to help them liberate their sort of own country, rather than us having to do it for them, I guess. So just on the back of that is a flag that I traded with one of the Iraqis. That's actually the Afghan flag.
Yep.
I don't know why he had it, but he wanted to trade for one of my badges. So I traded him for that. And then obviously my O positive blood group.
Oh, is that what that is?
Yeah, you have to have that obviously just to.
Now you mentioned there's a knife on table. Not drawn, I'd like to put out. you said there's a funny story behind this. Did you say that?
Yeah, so it's only a little, it's a HESCO knife. So anyone in the engineers would know what HESCO is. It's basically just a metal cage lined with a felt sack, which you can fill with pretty much anything. Obviously, we filled it with sand and dirt. And it just creates walls and infrastructure that is able to withstand and, you know, take firepower, basically. With every this little pocket knife here is what you get given in the bundles. So you get a bundle of 21 and they give you a little pocket knife to help you put it together. They're useless. They don't do anything really. They're kind of like a little novelty, but I've kept it just because it's funny the amount of knives that we got. This is obviously another thing that we had trade with the Iraqis as well because they loved them. But the guy who actually invented the HESCO bow is obviously a multi-millionaire. And what had actually happened to him, a funny story, is that he obviously made his millions and he was out on a Segway. He'd bought a Segway and he was doing some sort of trail near a cliff edge and he'd lost control of his Segway and ended up falling off the cliff on his Segway, which
I don't know why that's funny. I'm so sorry.
For me it just sounds like hilarious that he's like, because I think he was in the army,
right?
And he came up with the idea, and then when he left, he founded the company and started selling HESCO to the army. So like, I don't know. It's just always just kind of like hilarious to know that someone so successful would do something.
Go off the edge of a cliff on a Segway because he lost control.
So stupid, yeah. The knife itself is just funny because it's just a reminder of, because it's obviously folds out to be a multi-tool, but every time you'd sort of use the pliers to grip something, the pliers would snap or the knife wouldn't cut anything. It was just blunt as anything.
Cutting edge technology for the British Army.
Yeah.
So in terms of, you hear a lot in the press about like funding, sort of things being available. Was it as bad? Is it as bad? Is it fit for purpose? A lot of stuff. If you can't answer, then don't answer.
I think I've been out long enough. I mean, you could just Google it. and I'm sure there's loads of stories about it. So I would say no. I mean, the whole time we was in, we was always hearing rumours that, oh, we've just signed a deal with Mercedes, they're going to replace all of our vehicles and everything, or this, that and the other. But the reality is that the Land Rovers that we have in the army now, because as far as I'm aware, they haven't changed. They've been around since, you know, the 50s.
Yeah.
And I feel like if we were ever to go to war in some of these Land Rovers, they're held together by like duct tape. I wouldn't personally feel confident with the equipment that we have. But again, you've got to think that because we're not at a war, there's no reason to spend this money to rejuvenate it, because it still serves a purpose to us to train us and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But I feel like if a war did happen, the first thing they would have to do is replace a lot of the stuff that we have.
Yeah. Which is probably not even possible. And I think that's the fear, I suppose, of it. How quick can they really get all that stuff out?
I think it'd be pretty quick. I mean, it's always, history is quite fascinating to me, because if you look back at World War One and World War Two, and even if you go to like the British War Museum and you start at the beginning of the museum, and you'll see when the war began, and then towards the end of that war, how fast and how quickly technology came. So, for example, the First World War, it was trench warfare. People were on horses. You had single shot rifles. You was going into trenches with big batten sticks, bludgeoning people to death. And then by the end of the war, when you get to the end of the museum, you have a tank. You have mini guns. You have, you know, flamethrowers. There's gas masks and obviously chlorine gas. Like, there's such an advance in technology in that short space of time, just because the money demands it. And yeah, it's the same for World War Two. You know, the advancement of the tank, to go from the World War One tank that you'd see all the way up to what we have now, it's
mind-blowing, I suppose.
Money drives the market, I guess. And I think if a war breaks out, then instead of the money going to other areas that the government funds, it will just all go straight to us. All of our public aid will then stop, and then it would just be poured into the army, and they'd get the resources they need. But I think the biggest thing for me and the army is the financial sides of the soldiers itself. So I remember 3 years before I decided to leave that it was just announced that we was all going to be pay frozen, and they didn't have a determined date of when that was going to be lifted. So there was a lot of people at the time, because every year we used to go up a band, we used to call it. So every year you'd get a little bit of a raise and an incentive, obviously, to stay on and do more. But when they pay froze everyone, it kind of made you think, well, they have a lot more control over us than we think, because we can't then quit or strike or anything like that, because we've signed a contract to say that.
Yeah, our matey boy's got 24 years on a pay freeze.
Yeah, so it's tough, because then you see like the whole public sector is the same, isn't it? So the NHS want a raise, they go on strike. Junior doctors, they want a raise, they go on strike. For us, it's like we don't have that option. So it's kind of a bit annoying as well, because then you see all of this public sector striking, asking for raises, and it's just kind of like, right, they're going to give you the raise, but where does that money come from? And I bet you a lot of it comes from the military, and they go, right, well, we're just going to take an extra.
They can't moan about it. We'll just take it from them.
Take an extra.
It just 7%. Baffles me that we have people like yourself and doing what you've done, and you've got other people that, like you say, just do different areas within the army. They volunteering themselves up to put their life on the line to make life easier for all of us. And us privileged ones are all sitting here going, I'm going on strike because I'm not getting paid enough. And the poor sod that's actually making my life possible to live in a more safe environment, he's having his wages cut.
Yeah.
It's mental.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say cut because we never got cut.
No, but not. It's, let's be fair. You don't get paid what you should get paid. You might not see it, but from someone that's not involved, I would suggest your wages should be higher for that kind of sacrifice.
I think it's kind of the way it's structured, the pay system. It kind of feels a bit like commission based in a way, because for me, there's different types of people that were in the army at that time. I don't know if it's got worse. It's probably got worse now. But I noticed a massive change from when I joined to when I left, that the quality of person coming through wasn't as good as the ones that were there. Now, I think that's largely due to the fact that the army when I joined was at 350,000 personnel, and they planned to cut it back to 86,000. So what they had done is they offered up redundancy packages to people. Now, anyone who's smart read the redundancy package that they were offering and was like, that's a really good deal, because they're offering to finish paying out your contract and you didn't have to serve. So why would you not take that? So anyone with half a brain was like, yeah, I'll take that redundancy package. So then they actually have to finish, because obviously you have to give a year's notice and stuff. So to transition and make sure that there's enough people there. So when I've joined in, you're meeting all these, you know, savvy people, you're like, oh, wow, yeah, he's a good bloke. You know, he's a good role model, everything like that. But then when the redundancy packages sort of come into effect and people left, all of those people that you sort of looked up to and was like, yeah, he's...
They're all gone.
Good. They're all gone. And they're replaced by journeymen who are just there because they've stayed the course. And it was just getting worse and worse, because you're kind of like, I'm being run by a moron. And you're just kind of like, why am I listening to this? And this is part of the reason I decided to leave, because I was just sick of listening to...
So where's the logic in their numbers, though? Cutting it down from that kind of size, which it sounds loads, but when you really think about what we had, a nation of 60 plus million?
Yeah.
It's not a lot, really, is it?
I don't know what it was. I can't even remember who was in Parliament at the time that got passed, but they wanted to transition it to like a part-time army. But I feel like you need full-time soldiers, because we don't have a choice when we sign up. It's you're a soldier. You don't get to pick and choose. If you're in the sort of reserves or the territorial army, you can say, yeah, okay, you know, October I'll come and do a bit of soldiering, but only in October. And I just don't think you're going to get a good quality soldier from that. I feel like cutting it back must be a financial reason why they've done that. And I just don't know why. But what happened was, is they didn't cut back on any of the workload. So what was happening is people were leaving. The people they were bringing in weren't that great, and they weren't having any good role models to teach them and for them to follow into. But at the same time, the workload just stayed the same. So the people that were there were just getting overworked, because now you've got jobs that were being done by four people just being done by one person. You're just getting overworked. And then when they sort of done the pay freeze and everyone's like, well, now I'm being underpaid, not even being promoted anymore. It really affected, I think, the quality of soldier. And I don't know, I just sort of lost all motivation at that point, because I was just kind of like, well, I have to put up with this now, and I don't particularly want to anymore. I'd rather just leave and go travelling.
Yeah. Which you did and enjoyed.
Yeah, I did. That had its problems as well. Yeah.
So in terms of, you've got there three London Marathon medals.
Yes.
Did you beat your time each time?
Yes, it wasn't hard to do.
Right, so the first one was quite interesting. So the first one, you said you run for the charity Mind.
Yeah, so I ran for Mind, a mental health charity, whilst I was in. This was actually before I went to Iraq. I'd got the confirmation that I was going to run. And anyone that's been on tour knows that they go to Iraq to get absolutely massive. and it was kind of a bit of a decision based on the charity that I was running for, but it was also kind of a selfish reason because I just wanted to lift weights and become a unit. So I sort of said to myself, I'm not going to train for the marathon. And it was going to be just a battle between my mind and running the marathon.
At what mile did you realize that was a bad mistake?
So that particular one as well, I kind of made the mistake thinking that I had actually trained for it as well. So if you ask, because my family was tracking me, my brother said that I'd got to the half mile stage and I was only like an hour and 25 minutes in, which is like amateur runner time. So I'd pretty much...
And he would definitely know that to pull you up on that.
The occasion, yeah, certainly got the better of me. And I was just like, yeah, I'm just going to sprint this as fast as I can. And it was at that point that I was, yeah, really puffed. Lactic acid was really setting in. And then it was on mile 15. I wasn't really concentrating at that point. I was trying to zone out because my headphones had died, so I didn't have any music at that point. And what I'd done, because obviously when you're running, people are just sipping water and they're throwing water bottles here, there and everywhere. And I wasn't paying attention and I trod on a water bottle and slipped over a little bit. And I felt something go in my groin, obviously because I haven't trained. at that point, it really sort of hindered me. But I remember an old guy had said to me in the waiting pen beforehand, like, whatever you do, even if you're just, you know, walking, he said, like, don't stop moving forward. Like, so I ended up sort of hobbling that one. Took me like another 3.5 hours after that to get to the finish line.
I'm sure your brother let you know all about that.
Yeah. And then the second year they offered me the place to run again. This time I thought I'd do a bit of training. It wasn't really much more. It was just a bit more of like 5Ks, 10Ks that I'd do for that one. And yeah, I managed to do that like 2.5 hours quicker, I think. And then the final one was more of a fun one. I ran it for just because of my granddad that passed away. So I never really took that as a, okay, I'm going to set any records here.
Mate, listen, you've done it and you've passed the finish line 3 times more than a lot of people ever will. Something I'd love to do, I just know I can't.
The funny story is as well is that because I did the first one and it's a bronze medal and I did the second one and it was a silver.
Brilliant.
I found out that the company that makes the medals, they sign up to do 3 years of the medals. So when I know that this was bronze and this was silver and that this was going to be their final year,
it's a bit of gold.
I was like, yeah, it's going to be a gold. So I have to run it.
I've got to finish next one. So I've got a full set.
And that was like 50% of the motivation.
I can tell you, I don't even remember it, but me and your brother did the Great South Run.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he, same thing, mate. I think the night before, me and him was having a kebab.
Yeah.
And everyone else is like doing their stretches in the lobby of the hotel and all taking it really serious.
Yeah.
I was tired at the pre-workout from the guy that was on the crane getting everyone warmed up at the start line.
Yeah.
And Lee said to me, yeah, I can't stay at this pace. You know, he's like, I'm off. Yeah. That was it. He was gone. Didn't see him anymore.
I know the until story. I got to I know the 2 story miles. You're gonna tell me, yeah.
And there he was hobbling along with a man in his 70s. And I was like, Lee, what's up? And he's like, oh my God, I'm in trouble. And I had to drag him round the rest. Yeah. I think I'm pretty sure it was half a marathon.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, Great Southern Run, yeah.
So, yeah, and I ended up dragging him across the line, which was very ironic because he was definitely fitter than I was.
Did he also not... I was told a story that he also tried to sprint at the end to beat you.
And he couldn't. It's great. And I think there used to be photos at the end of it.
Yeah.
It looked like Thelma and Louise crossing the line hand in hand because I had to drag his ass.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it was, like I said, it's a great sense of achievement, and that's only half that, so I can't imagine.
Yeah.
I think we were just starting, and at the time, Paula Radcliffe had just finished it in, like, 40-odd minutes or something stupid.
I think it gets to a point, though, like, in all three of these that I ran, it got to a point where it didn't even matter anymore.
Yeah.
Like, I could probably have gone another 10 miles, and it would have felt the same. Like, it gets to a point where your body just goes,
I think the bleakest
I
mile...
need help.
Was the second but last.
Hmm.
So I've got a feeling it was 11 miles. I don't know why I've got that. It was 12 miles. Was top. Is that right? Half a marathon? I feel like it was 12.
Well, it's 26.2 for...
Right, so it must have been just short.
So it's 13, I think.
Yeah, well, it might have been 13, but I just remember the second from last mile was just bleak.
Yeah.
It was right down south, I think it was South Sea or whatever it's called. Near Portsmouth, and it was literally just right out of the way, and it was like one woman that was waving a little flag on a road, and it just went on forever, and it was because there was no one around, there was no crowds, because it was just the turning bit when you get back onto the seafront to finish, and then you join the part, what they call the party mile, welcome to the last one, and it was just like bands playing and all that, so that bit got you through and lots of people cheering, so it gets you over the line, but that towards the end,
but that's the other thing as bleak. Well, yeah, with the London marathons, there's so many people there, so
just cheering you on,
you don't have to it sort of ignites a fire within to just go as soon as someone, like, because obviously you've got your name on your shirt as well. And you just hear from someone, go on. And they call your name out, and then you're like, yeah, go on.
Exactly, right. Get you through.
I'm going to sprint the next kilometre now.
Exactly, got that boost. So, just finishing up, do you regret anything? Do you regret going in? Do you regret doing it? Would you do it differently if you could do it again?
No. I think I would join earlier.
Yep.
I would join at 16. And I think... as awful as it sounds, I probably wouldn't want to be in a relationship.
Right.
Not for any other reason than the fact that it kind of hindered me, in the sense that I'd always want to come home to see the partner at the time. Because I had two relationships when I was in there, and I'd always want to come home and see my partner.
As long as they went at the same time, mate, we're good.
No. And I'd always want to come see them and spend the weekend with them, but then I missed out on a lot of things with the people that I served with.
Yeah.
And I'd always spend my week sort of planning for the weekend. So I never really, like, signed up to... I mean, I did a lot, but I didn't sign up to more things because I was kind of like, oh, but...
Trying to get the mix right.
Yeah. I've got to see her. And
I think that's like a fair comment, mate.
But yeah, I definitely would have joined earlier. I think... I still would have joined the engineers, maybe. If I was able to join the intelligence corps, then I probably would have gone after that. It's, I don't know, something I really was interested in. But, yeah, in terms of, like, joining the army completely, like, I still think it was good because I didn't know what I wanted to do. So it was good to join because it sort of helped me understand what I wanted to do when I left.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't regret it. I think anyone asked me if they should join or, you know, what it was like and stuff, I try and give them a very... honest opinion and, like, try and kill their dream a little bit, because I feel like a lot of people think they're going to join and it's going to be something it's not. So I do kind of, like, bring it down a little bit. I still encourage them to
personally,
do it.
Personally, mate, I think it's been a breath of fresh air to actually hear someone, like you say, not over-exaggerate. Because as you said, you rightly said earlier, right, the people that are going to tell you stuff is probably bullshit.
Yeah.
The ones that really, really went through the torment, probably not really going to tell you much, and not unless they're skint and got a purpose to sell a book or whatever, and then they'll start going into it, maybe.
Yeah.
The reality is you're telling it as it is.
Yeah.
This was the experience, this is how it was, and I think people need to know that.
Yeah.
Because, like you said, I think people get a perception. Everyone thinks it's Hollywood to some degree, and it's not. Like, you've just made that clear.
No, it's... I saw a funny video online once, and it was an American soldier, and he was moving sandbags from one pallet to another pallet that was 300 meters away. And the person who was on the camera said, you know, what are you doing? And he went, I'm moving these sandbags from here to there. And they said, well, why are you doing that? He went, I don't fucking know. I'm in the army. And I feel like that just sums up a lot of your time in there. It's doing things that don't really make sense a lot of the time. Yeah. But I guess there is a reason behind it, because it kind of makes you obedient and a soldier, I guess. But yeah, a lot of the times it is just stupid things like filling sandbags and emptying the sandbag straight afterwards, because they just want to keep you busy. And yeah, there's so many times where you just sat there doing nothing and they'll get you to do a task that had no benefit at all apart from just wasting your time, because they had nothing to give you
to do.
So yeah, it's certainly not all about running and gunning and you know, Call of Duty streaks.
Just keep it to Call of Duty. Yeah.
yeah you're better off getting a Twitch stream and playing video games.
Look how much money you could have made doing that, because you used to be shit up.
Yeah, I mean, I spent a lot of time on there, certainly.
In the loft.
Yeah, I used to, I think I would have played against you at some time.
Probably,
yeah.
Slaughtered me.
I remember Lee used to give it the big one to people online.
Hand you the control.
And then say, I'll play me and my brother, and then he would invite like six of his friends, and yeah, I'd end up turning them all over. And he'd be like, yeah, we got you, and sort of take all the credit. But yeah.
That sounds just like him.
But no, I think that was just a stopgap for me to find out.
Ah, perfect.
For myself, yeah.
Brilliant, mate. Well, I thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you.
Yeah, no, it's good to be here.
No, I'm going to say, mate, it's nice to hear you, the inside of it all, and what you went through and how it all panned out. So you've got to ask you the Greg's question now, mate.
Oh, yeah.
So you're going to Greg's, what are you buying?
You know what, if you asked me this before I left for travelling, there would have been an answer that I would have given. And that would have been a cat's ass and a steak bake. And then probably just a drink. You probably don't know what a cat's ass is, actually. Yeah.
Elaborate.
It's a sausage roll. It's a funny thing in the army that you used to get these horrible like lunch packs, which had a sandwich in it, a sausage roll, and a packet of Tato crisps. And the sausage rolls always used to look... The sausage was just pink.
Right, okay.
And obviously the brown outside, so it just used to look like a cat's ass. So that's what we call sausage rolls. But no, I think I came back and I was really excited to try Greg's again, and I had it and I was just like, this is awful. Like,
it's gone downhill.
I think they've changed. They must have changed the recipes in that. But yeah, the steak bake tastes exactly the same. So if it was me, three steak bakes.
Three steak bakes, yeah, don't blame
Or me. A Yum Yum, actually. Yeah, a pack of Yum Yums.
Not one, we're having a pack.
Yeah, a pack of Yum Yums.
A pack of steak bakes, pack of Yum Yums.
Three for two on steak bakes. Exactly. And a pack of Yum Yums. And then a drink just to wash it down.
Nah, but brilliant, mate. Thank you so much.
Yeah, no
worries. Probably enjoyed it. It's good to catch up.
Yeah.
And yeah, good luck.
Thank you very much.
Top man.
Thanks.